Well, thanks, Alan, and thank you all of you for getting up so early. I should qualify my thank you. You asked me to come and talk at this, which I said I would be delighted to do, and about 3 weeks later, there's another listening session going on right now in Alaska who asked me if I could come up, and I had to say, unfortunately.
Would you rather be in Alaska?
Right, it would be pretty interesting right now. As Alan said, I'm going to talk about Synthesis and Assessment Product 4.6. For reasons known only to the federal government, we have not only that title, but they're all by numbers. And if you do try and find them, you have to search by number. They're very difficult to find on the website any other way. So those of us involved in them have this whole vocabulary that is incomprehensible to anybody else. The author team, as you can see, is listed up here. It was led by Janet Gamble at the Office of Research and Development in US EPA. And we focused on three major issues. One was human health. One was essentially settlements, which was led by Tom Wilbanks. And one is human well-being, which was led by Fran Sussman. We had 28 experts from academia, government, the private sector. I have a whole series of slides that just give you the conclusions. And I know you can all read, and I really don't like putting up slides that are nothing but words. So I'll also talk while you're reading, because I know everybody can multitask. In thinking about the health impacts, I'd like to repeat something that I said yesterday, is when we're looking at the needs from the public health community. And I think it's worth repeating it, because as you look at the questions, I think this framing will be helpful in looking at the questions that we would like to have you address. Is the first need in the public health community is better understanding of how weather affects our health. And that's directly and indirectly. It's easy to understand from heat waves, droughts, those kinds of issues. But we're also affected indirectly because weather affects where we see various vectors. It affects the rate at which a variety of pathogens replicate. There's a whole series of ways that weather then will play through other kinds of variables and affect human health. And in looking at that category, I want to include all of the confounding factors, all of the other factors that drive the health outcomes we're worried about, from heat waves to foodborne disease, vector-borne diseases. Lots of things besides temperature and precipitation affect the geographic range and the incidence of those diseases. So it's a very complex set of questions that need to be addressed. And that has been where most of the focus has been on the research in the U.S. When you look at the summary in this chapter, almost all of the research addresses that area. There's still large research needs, and the questions, as you can see, are asking questions of what kind of information do we need to be able to understand those relationships a lot better. The second major category, I'm sure you finished reading that, the second major category then are studies seeking for evidence, indeed, that climate change has affected the geographic range or incidence of any kind of health-sensitive health outcome, or weather-sensitive health outcome. And those studies, by and large, have not been done. And there's a lot going on in the biological sciences, ecosystems work, but there's not really anything that's been done seriously on that in the U.S. The third major category are then projections. What do we expect could happen with climate change to this wide range of climate-sensitive health outcomes? And we have projections for the U.S., a few projections for heat waves, for air quality, specifically for ozone, a few other things, but really not much. So there's been very limited work in the U.S. looking at projections. And if you go to the IPCC chapter, you'll see that there's been projections from quite a wide range of places, that the literature is much richer than it has been for the U.S. And then finally, the fourth, and it's also a very broad category, is what kinds of responses are there. And I'll have a slide later on adaptation. We were asked to focus only on adaptation. We were told not to focus on mitigation. But there are huge research agendas on how will public health be able to respond to the risks that climate change is presenting. And that's what the next speakers are going to talk about. Here's a major conclusions from the settlements chapter. Not terribly surprising. It was quite interesting throughout this process because essentially across these three major categories of issues, our meetings consisted of who's got the less amount of literature. And it was a battle for the bottom. And Tom Wilbanks is close to the bottom because there's very little work done on settlements, on cities, on how this is going to affect human well-being. And then the well-being was mostly just a framing of how do we think about human well-being in terms of climate change, because, again, there's almost no literature on it. And so there was a lot of effort put in by Fran Sussman and Gramsci to say, how do we think about these issues and start framing the kind of work that needs to be done. As I said, we were asked to focus only on adaptation. We did not include consideration of mitigation. And as is true in most of the assessments that have been done recently, much of the adaptation focuses much more on the theoretical level of the principles of adaptation, the kinds of things that we know need to be done. The real challenge in doing an assessment is because the impacts of climate change are site-specific and path-dependent, that the actual impacts observed will depend on the local context. Therefore, you need to understand the local context to say something very specific about adaptation. You can talk in general about early warning systems, but to say what works in a particular community, you have to understand characteristics of that community to provide a rich amount of detail. And also, there's a tremendous amount of work in the U.S. on all of the weather-sensitive health outcomes. We do try and control mortality from heat waves, droughts, I'm not speaking very well this morning, it's way too early, and for vector-borne diseases, we have large surveillance programs. The question is, how does one adjust those? And that is a very serious and complicated question of how do you start using projections? How do you start thinking about, we don't honestly at this moment in time know exactly the geographic range of many vectors. If climate change is likely to change the range of those vectors, what does that imply for our surveillance programs? And how do we think about when and where we start making changes when we have a set budget? Because if we make changes to one particular area, we start increasing surveillance somewhere, we're going to have to decrease it somewhere else. Not easy questions, and people are starting to talk about that and have not really made as much progress as we think should be made. As Alan mentioned, this is the website, so if you go here, you can get just a wealth of information. To find this particular synthesis and assessment product, you need to search on 4.6. Searching on human health will give you pages and pages of stuff every time anybody mentioned health in any synthesis and assessment product, so you need to search on 4.6 and you can find it. So thank you.
Thanks, Chris. So the next speaker is Howie Frumkin. Howie is director of the National Center for Environmental Health and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Prior to that, he was a professor of environmental and occupational health and of medicine at Emory University, and he has a very broad-ranging set of research and policy interest and work from minority health to built environment to climate change. And he'll tell us a bit today about the public health response to climate change.
Thanks, Alan. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming out to this. I do want to talk briefly about public health response to climate change, but I want to frame it in the context of public health input to the CCSP, which is what this session is all about. I invite you to think about the question, if there were a federal program in this country dealing with climate change or climate science, what would you want it to look like? What would you want it to do? Would you want it just to be a research program? Would you want it to be a program that extends beyond scientific research to decision support? Do you think it ought to have an information dissemination role? In other words, should it not only collect science, but should it push it out? Do you think it ought to have a training role? Do you think that part of a scientific institution has to do with training scientists in the field? So from a public health point of view, as you make those comments, think about what would best serve the intersection of climate science and public health, and think very broadly about the way an entity like the Climate Change Science Program, that's like flouts and druds, we're doing it too, ought to function. CCSP morphed into its current form with this current administration, and that means that it's quite likely that changes will occur after the election. And that means that it's an opportune time to think about the way you want the entire program to position itself and the functions that you think it ought to have. So think not only about those functions, but think about the structure of the program. In particular, it now functions rather passively as a gathering spot for the individual agencies that are components of it. But it doesn't make decisions about research direction, and it doesn't allocate funds. So the real center of gravity of decision-making and work is in the individual agencies. And what that means is that if an individual agency doesn't have much of a commitment to climate change work and doesn't put money into climate change work, then that work's not likely to happen. And that has been the history of health in the climate change science program, because HHS has not had a commitment to health research and climate change. EPA and NOAA over time have had something of a commitment, but they're relatively small. Health isn't their main line of business. So if you think that one of the ways to rectify that is through an umbrella program like CCSP, that would be a kind of recommendation you'd want to make. If, on the other hand, you think that the decision-making ought to stay at the individual agencies, then you'd want to focus your recommendations on HHS, and you'd want to ask that more resources be put into climate change at the level of HHS. So the overall functions of CCSP and the structure of the program are both fair game for comments, and I invite you to do that. Chris mentioned this split between the physical sciences and the human side of things. And I think it's safe to say that the predominance of activity at CCSP, reflecting the predominance of activity in the member agencies for years, has been on the physical science side. The National Academies reviewed the CCSP portfolio this year and very emphatically came to that conclusion as well, echoing conclusions that many of us in the health sector have reached about the CCSP. So you may want to make recommendations addressing the relative balance of the earth sciences and physical sciences and the human side of things, health, well-being, human activities like urban settlements and how those are affected. Chris also mentioned the conceptual division between mitigation and adaptation, in the fact that the authors of the SAP 4.6 were directed to focus on adaptation. But consider that a possible basis for comment as well. You may want to tell the CCSP that a health-related effort ought to be directed not just to the adaptation side, but to the mitigation side, because you may think that mitigation strategies, do we go for biofuels, do we go for cap and trade, so on, will have health impacts. And you may think that what we ought to be about, in part, is anticipating and analyzing the health impacts of various mitigation strategies so that we can put that perspective into decision-making. So, to summarize those last two points, don't necessarily take for granted the current balance of physical science versus the human side. Don't necessarily take for granted the current focus on adaptation at the expense of mitigation. Input on the relative balance there would be very appropriate as well. Last point, the public health approach to climate change. There's been a lot written on this in the last few years, especially focusing on adaptation. The general public health approach that we all know is based on the core functions of public health, and you've all seen the list of those 10 core functions, the surveillance function, the investigation function, the communication function, plans and policy making, research, and so on. I would invite you to think in those terms because that is a very tested and useful framework for thinking about public health activity. So as you give advice to the CCSP from the public health point of view, you may want to anchor your advice in the core functions of public health. You may, for example, want to say to the CCSP that research ought to be carried out and it ought to focus on particular aspects of public health that we know to be important, and you may want to specify what those would look like. So you'll probably, if you do that, talk about infectious diseases, relatively well recognized. You may talk about severe weather events, relatively well recognized. You may also talk about health impacts that have received much less attention, like mental health, or you may talk about equity issues, environmental justice, and health disparities, which have not been very well developed in the dialogue on health impacts of climate change. If you talk about making plans, doing preparedness planning, you may focus on the need for modeling and forecasting techniques to be much better developed and to be disseminated so that local users can use those techniques to anticipate what's liable to happen. I won't go on, but suffice it to say that I think the core functions of public health do provide a very useful framework for what we would want a science-based climate change program nationally to do, and probably a useful framework for thinking about public health input. Any questions? John.
The idea of the structure and taking this from being something that's agency-driven bottom-up to something that's more top-down and has its own budget authority, something I've been dealing with nanotech, and there are obvious constraints about that in the federal government. And I'm just wondering, the CCSP was created by an act of Congress, and I'm not sure if the act of Congress enable and permit such a fundamental change in the structure, or would we really be having to say the whole CCSP as it exists under this act needs to be shelved and we need a new act that would create maybe like a climate change science commission, like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that is a separate freestanding entity that then could do something like that. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
The form of the CCSP is partially specified by the, I think it's called the Climate Science Act of about 1990 or so. Global Change Research Act. Yeah, thanks. And it was the U.S. Global Change Research Program, GCRP, and then it changed to its current form. So it's partially specified. There is some flexibility in it, as was demonstrated by the last change in form. But I think for purposes of a listening session, input from constituencies like public health, you should think broadly and freely. If a lot of suggestions emerge to CCSP about changes in form that would require an act of Congress, there's a Congress that can pass acts. So it would be useful for the CCSP to hear that. Dean.
Well, let me just follow up on that. The federal government is replete with interagency coordinating committees and centers, and it's a very common approach to dealing with multi-sectorial problems. I kind of assume, based on your list, very thoughtful list, that it was also not just a random selection that you chose to highlight. So I think you've probably been doing thinking on that. But my question is really, when you look across the federal government, do you have models in mind of where this kind of organization, the interagency organization, has really formed into an agency or a group that then has kind of super agency resources and decision-making authority versus where it's really stayed in this kind of forum, where it's really been more just a forum for communication among the agencies?
I do, but so does Chris. After you.
One example was the joint announcement on climate variability and human health, which is NOAA, NASA, NSF, EPA, and the Electric Power Research Institute, and for 5 years funded across the agency in a way that has been celebrated actually by the current administration as a model for how to do one form of interagency cooperation on an issue where you need multiple agencies because each has different areas of expertise. Obviously, you want NOAA on board because it has the weather expertise. EPA on board because at that point in time, they're the major ones funding human health kinds of activities. So there have been models, and that's one that's been put forward multiple times as a way to ensure that you use more systems-based, broad-based thinking about these issues and how to address.
Another couple of models that come to mind, one is the Czar model. We've done the Czar model with drugs and with HIV, and so there's sort of a moral authority that oversees and pulls together different agencies that may not otherwise come together. And another is the executive order that directs agencies to work together. We've seen that with Children's Environmental Health. That's an example that people in this room will know well. So a number of existing models in government for pulling together efforts across government. And you may think of some others in the course of input today. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Howie. So, and yes, I know of other models as well, but I would prefer that we listen to the other two presenters first, and then we will have a lot of opportunity for much fuller discussion. So the next speaker is Jonathan Patz. Jonathan is a professor of environmental studies and population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He directs the university-wide initiative on global environmental health, and he's authored over 75 publications on the health impacts of global environmental change. He'll speak to some of the research opportunities related to climate change. Jonathan.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Alan. And Alan asked me to just talk about some of the research priorities. Since I've been working on climate change research for 16 years, and I just wanted to give you some of my perspectives on where I think we've made some great gains, but where we really ought to be taking this. I think there are three areas of research that are important to pursue. The first one is a better assessment of baseline conditions of climate-related health outcomes. The second one is to do directed surveillance and monitoring for areas that we think are hotspot areas that we ought to be looking for change. And the third, and I think most important, area of research is looking at both unintended consequences and co-benefits of changing energy, transportation, and agriculture. John Balbus told me of an interesting quote yesterday about someone saying that public health, was it you, John? Public health is too important to leave just to public health experts.
Sounds good, but it wasn't me.
Howie? Howie. All right, I'm sorry, it was from Howie or whatever. Okay, so anyway, this is an area especially where it's not single agent toxin or microbiological agent. This is a completely different environmental health hazard, and we need a different approach. So let me just quickly give some examples. For baseline conditions, certainly we need to understand our adequacy of heat and storm watch, warning, and response systems, air pollution levels, which we have a pretty good handle on, the prevalence of weather-sensitive diseases, and also a big one, which I think we're lacking in, is the condition of our water and sanitation treatment systems that are leaking and failing all over the country already, and with increases in the hydrologic cycle, increased pressure differentials on these pipes, increased runoff, combined sewage overflow events, these types of things. This is a great need. We need to understand the condition of our water systems. And that this is an intersectoral problem. Climate change cannot be viewed in isolation, and so when we do our research on urban heat waves, for example, we need to account for the landscape and the urban design and look at the urban heat island effect that we know about. Also, we're conducting work internationally, and there have been global warming models that show increased temperature or rainfall across the Amazon. And the question is, well, how will that affect malaria? And a lot of these models show that, you know, if the rain goes up, more malaria. Well, guess what? Out of our center, we've looked at the effect of wetlands, and we looked at the effect of precipitation and found out it was a different sign. You know, more rain in one area meant decreased malaria, and that same rainfall in another area meant increase in malaria. It turns out to be related to how much wetlands there are, and it may be a matter of stagnant water. The bottom line is, to study climate change and disease response, we need to know what's on the land, you know, land cover change, those issues. So we have to be very careful as we apply climate assessments to disease and understand the other contributing factors. So that's the baseline conditions. And surveillance and monitoring, certainly we have great air pollution monitoring in place. That's pretty obvious, and that needs to continue. Waterborne pathogens. Actually, there's a student here, Chris Uweggio, who's working on an EPA grant that we've got, an EPA STAR grant, monitoring rainfall and runoff and beach contamination and looking at pathogens. Well, it turns out, you know, our indicator bacteria right now is E. coli. And Chris, aren't you finding that from your colleagues, most of the E. coli is from seagulls? You know, that we really need better indicators for you know, for human pollution as well. Of course, cryptosporidiosis comes from livestock as well. But right now, we need better indicators for waterborne diseases, because this is going to be a problem with climate change as the water cycle increases. And Chris Eby already mentioned insect-borne disease surveillance. There are a dearth of programs right now that are actually catching mosquitoes and monitoring them. It costs money, so we need to be targeted as far as doing better vector surveillance to look for change in some of these diseases. But we can't do that all over the country. We're going to have to prioritize with hotspots. So finally, this third issue, the co-benefits and unintended consequences of mitigating climate change. Because right now, I think, you know, the train is leaving the station, and yes, people are aware of climate change. We're worried about it. We are moving quickly. Well, not quickly enough, but the awareness is up, and we're moving to the realization that we need to change our energy systems. That's happening. So we need to be on board when we start changing our energy system, which hopefully we will be doing. And we need to look at the co-benefits and unintended consequences, because I think these are going to overshadow the health risks. Another student from Wisconsin, Maggie Grabo, presented on Monday about the Triple Wind Biking Project. And you guys have seen all of these stories about the built environment and climate change. If we green our cities, it reduces greenhouse gases, but it makes us healthier. The Triple Wind Biking is, you know, if we had better biking and walkability in cities, we'd be more fit, we'd have less obesity, diabetes, we'd have less local air pollution, and we'd reduce greenhouse gases for the broader issue. That policy shift of having more monorails, bicycles, and sidewalks instead of cars and trucks, that health benefit could far outshadow all of the health risks combined. So we need to assess that and put that on the table and quantify these benefits. We've heard throughout this conference about meat and livestock as a contributor to climate change, so that if we reduce our meat diet and get rid of the concentrated animal feed operations, the CAFOs, that would have a benefit reducing greenhouse gases. But of course, we know that too much meat in our diet is a problem, so there's another co-benefit. Sort of related to, well, not related to livestock, related to agriculture, we now know that agriculture, energy, and health are all one and the same. I've heard Howie say before, public health policy really equals transportation policy, energy policy, and agricultural policy. These are very intertwined, and our research needs to reflect that. Dave Wallinga showed me a new story came out last week that from producing corn ethanol, the distiller grain that's left over from producing corn ethanol is then fed to livestock. And last week there was a report out that showed a tenfold increase in E. coli 0157, the dangerous E. coli, in cattle that eat distiller grain. That's a side effect we ought to know about and put on the table for our research agenda. And I saw a very interesting presentation by Eric Hill up at our biofuel center at Wisconsin that showed that the upstream production of corn ethanol, the diesel and the fertilizer and the ammonia used to make corn ethanol, will increase particulate PM 2.5 in the country. Now, when you burn ethanol compared to burning gasoline, that's less PM. But when you make ethanol, just in making the ethanol, the production of that would lead to more PM 2.5 compared to the equivalent energy burned for gasoline. So these are things that, you know, they're not bullseye for us as far as what we're used to looking at, but this is what we really need to embrace. And with that, I will just conclude by saying, these all are within this new frame, relatively new framework that we've been talking about, which is a health impact assessment framework that goes beyond just looking at that the risk factors and looks upstream, looks at costs, looks at benefits, looks at equity issues as far as who's more vulnerable. So I think that this is where you know, this broader framework is important. And the bottom line is, this research is not going to be coming out of one agency. All the speakers before me have said, and thank goodness we have this institution, this interagency institution, because it's going to have to be coordinated to get the breadth of the research challenge.
Thanks, Jonathan. So our last short presentation is from